The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post and National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are simply selected for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we visit some familiar places that connect to bygone eras in some truly unique ways. First, we visit two Virginia estates central to George Washington's life, but share little common ground. Writer Jim Barnes' article appeared in the June 21, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. Many Americans are aware that George Washington lived at Mount Vernon near Alexandria, Virginia, a historic site where they can walk in the footsteps of our nation's foremost founding father, Revolutionary War hero and first president. What's less well known is that Washington grew up 40 miles south of there at what is called now Ferry Farm near Fredericksburg, and the site, the setting for such mythical events as chopping down his father's cherry tree and throwing a coin across the river, can be visited as well. Both locations provide a fascinating window into Washington's life. And this year, both have something new to offer visitors. In January, this was 2018, the Donald W. Reynolds Museum and Education Center at Mount Vernon completed a $2 million upgrade of its Revolutionary War Theater and unveiled a new 4D film focusing on Washington's role in the war. And in May 2018, Ferry Farm, where Washington lived from age 6 until moving to Mount Vernon at 22, opened a replica of the Washington family's house for guided tours. I ambitiously set out to see both of Washington's home sites on a rainy Monday in early June. My day begins with breakfast at Mercantile, a cheerful, cozy restaurant in Fredericksburg's historic downtown, where I enjoy some strong coffee and a delicious omelet made with chopped tomato, fresh basil, red onions, mozzarella, and goat cheese. Ferry Farm is just a stone's throw from downtown Fredericksburg, about a five-minute drive down King's Highway, unless you miss the tiny roadside entrance sign and have to circle across the Rappahannock River and back again, as I did. The tour of the site, with the exception of the house itself, is self-guided. Visitors are given an iPad to take with them as they walk along a path that loops through the property. Flags mark various stops where visitors can use the iPad to watch short videos, look at pictures, and listen to narration about the Washington family's life at the farm. The tour winds through a demonstration garden along an area where enslaved workers lived, down a steep hill and past Ferry Lane to the river. In an iPad video, the farm's director of archaeology, Dave Maraca, explains, or demonstrates rather, how easy or not it would have been to throw a stone across the Rappahannock at that point. The original legend said Washington was strong enough to throw a rock, not a coin, across the river. Visitors are invited to try it for themselves. Tony Stevenson, a tour guide at the reconstructed house, says that the Washington's home, built on land rising above the river, high above the river, as a matter of fact, would have led to a clear commanding view of Fredericksburg. More important, the house could be seen from the city, a declaration of the bustling trade center that important people lived there. Known at the time as the Washington Home Farm, it was a transportation hub positioned between King's Highway and a high point of the Rappahannock, where ships brought goods all the way from Britain. A nearby lane led to a ferry across the river, so young George would have had the opportunity to encounter more worldly travelers who were passing through. Over time, it became known as the Ferry Farm. Augustine Washington died in 1743 when George was 11, leaving his widow land rich and cash poor. With five children in her custody, Stevenson says. When George was in his late teens, his older brother, Lawrence Washington, helped him secure a position as a surveyor for William Fairfax, Lawrence's father-in-law, who was one of the largest landowners in Virginia. This afforded Washington the opportunity to gain valuable insights about the land in the region and also to invest in self-improvement, lessons and experience in dancing, card playing, fencing, and billiards. The social skills he gained while living at the Ferry Farm enabled him to move comfortably into high society, Stevenson says. After Lawrence's death, George inherited his brother's plantation, Mount Vernon. He moved there in 1754 and sold the Fredericksburg property 20 years later. Over the ensuing decades, Washington's early home was nearly forgotten. The original house had been neglected and eventually collapsed in the early 19th century, leaving few traces. It wasn't until 2006 that archaeologists found the first evidence in the house's foundation. In 2015, the George Washington Foundation began reconstructing Washington's childhood house on the site of the original building. Stevenson explains that there were no paintings or drawings of the house, so the reconstruction was based on archaeological evidence, documents such as Augustine Washington's probate inventory, and houses occupied by similar families at the time. The replica house, a wooden structure with red paint, is modest by today's standards. It has only 8 rooms, 2 of which are little more than openings at the top and bottom of the staircase. Nevertheless, Stevenson says it would have been one of the area's finest homes in Washington's time. The house is sparsely furnished, and little attempt has been made to make it appear lived in. 2 bed frames lack mattresses and bedding, and some of the rooms are mostly empty. The tour does give visitors a sense of the close quarters in which the Washington family lived and offers a striking contrast to the luxury of Mount Vernon, my next destination. Although Mount Vernon is only an hour's drive up Interstate 95 from Ferry Farm, it seems like a world away. The contrast between the two attractions are immediately evident as I approach the entrance and pass one tour bus after another lining the road. First on my agenda is a 20-minute self-guided tour of the mansion. To control the crowds, only a certain number of visitors are allowed to start the tour every few minutes. As I wait for my timed entry, I explore the gardens, grounds, and slaves' quarters and look on historical interpreters in period costumes chat with visitors. There are similarities between the Mount Vernon Mansion and the house at Ferry Farm. Both were riverfront homes on plantations once owned by Augustine Washington, but the tour experiences could hardly have been more different. At Ferry Farm, I had been joined only by a couple from New York for an in-depth 40-minute guided tour of the reconstructed home. At Mount Vernon, guides were stationed throughout the mansion tour, repeating one-minute spiels as dozens of visitors shuffled past, pausing briefly for questions, before starting their spiel again. As a former tour guide, I felt a little sorry for them. We see the central passage, the oldest part of the mansion, which contains the only original furnishing we're allowed to touch, a polished wooden banister. We also walk past a guest bedroom, the new room, main event hall, 2 parlors, a dining room, the Washington's bedroom, and in separate structures, the kitchen and a building where the guest servants stayed. The mansion at Mount Vernon is immense in comparison with the house at Ferry Farm. It has 21 rooms, including 9 guest bedrooms. There are no bathrooms, however, and no indoor plumbing. Instead, the Washingtons and their guests use chamber pots and outhouses. A guide says that strangers sometimes shared the guest rooms when the Washingtons had more guests than rooms for them. In the private bedroom where George Washington died, we see the original bed shared by the Washingtons during their 41-year marriage. In the kitchen, we learn that late in life, the president only had 1 tooth. His dentures were mainly for presentation, not eating, so he mostly ate soft foods. When the tour ends, I head to the Museum and Education Center to see the film and spend the remainder of my time browsing through the exhibits. I realized then that one could easily spend a full day at Mount Vernon. A visit of 2 to 3 hours merely scratches the surface. The impressive 17-minute film in the Revolutionary War Theater gives viewers an immersive, up-close look at Washington's wartime experience. The new wide aspect ratio screen and surround sound system are enhanced by close-up shots and special effects that draw viewers into the battles. Lights flash and our chairs shake when cannons are fired, and the fog and snow appear at times to simulate the weather. Even though we know now how the movie Brother will end, the film does a good job of building suspense by showing the immense challenges Washington and his troops faced and overcame to defeat the mighty British forces and gain independence for the colonies. Mount Vernon's food court and the highly regarded Mount Vernon Inn restaurant are popular with visitors. However, by the end of my visit, I'm ready for a change of pace. I decide to check out Supolo, a Peruvian chicken restaurant just 10 minutes away in Alexandria. The spicy roasted chicken is as good as its reviews suggest, a crispy, juicy, and full of flavor. The rice and black beans are also moist and tasty. It's a meal that latter-day George Washington could only have enjoyed in his dreams. Well, Jim Barnes is a writer based in Leesburg, Virginia, and he has a website if you'd like to learn more about what he does. His website is notesinletters.com, notesinletters.com. So there you have some more information and so forth. And he does offer some tips where to eat if visiting. He suggests Mercantile at 205 William Street in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and you can check that online at mercantilerestaurant.com, M-E-R-C-A-N-T-I-L-E. Some people say mercantile, but it's mercantilerestaurant.com. Open for breakfast and lunch, Mercantile is a friendly restaurant serving omelets, flatbreads, sandwiches, salads, and outstanding coffee. Breakfasts start from $9, salads, and flatbreads from $11, and sandwiches start at $12. And then we have Kybecca, K-Y-B-E-C-C-A, at 400 William Street in Fredericksburg. Check it out at Kybecca.com. That's Kybecca.com. It serves contemporary American food with a dinner menu featuring soups, salads, steak, seafood, and vegetarian dishes. The house burger costs $15. Other entrees start at $20. Then we have the Orofino at 1006 Caroline Street in Fredericksburg, Virginia. OrofinoRestaurant.com is where you find more information. Online, Orofino, O-R-O-F-I-N-O, OrofinoRestaurant.com. The Italian restaurant serves salads, flatbreads, sandwiches, pastas, and entrees such as pork chops, grilled veal, melanzana siciliana, a breaded eggplant dish served with spaghetti. Sandwiches from $8, pastas from $9, and other entrees from $14. Reservations are recommended for this restaurant. Again, that's Orofino. Then we have the Mount Vernon Inn restaurant at 3200 Mount Vernon Memorial Highway in Mount Vernon, Virginia. Online, it is mountvernon.org/inn. mountvernon.org/inn. Popular with visitors to Mount Vernon, this traditional American restaurant is on the site of George Washington's estate. Regional and colonial specialties include peanut and chestnut soup, skillet cornbreads, turkey pie, crab cake sandwiches, and shrimp and grits. Salads start at $9. Sandwiches and entrees go from $14 and up. Then we have that Supolo, that's the word S-U, and then Polo, P-O-L-L-O, at 8741 Richmond Highway in Alexandria, Virginia. And SupoloRestaurant.com is where you get more information online. SupoloRestaurant.com. Authentic Peruvian Polo a la Brasa, that's blackened rotisserie chicken, is the star of the casual No Frills restaurant, just a 10-minute drive from Mount Vernon. Sides include yucca fries, plantains, rice and beans, and chicken platters from $7.25, and sandwiches and other entrees start at about $8. Now, about things to do, well, George Washington's Ferry Farm, this is at 268 Kings Highway in Fredericksburg, Virginia. More information about that at kenmore.org/ff_home.html. That's kenmore.org/ff_home.html to learn more about George Washington's Ferry Farm in Fredericksburg. This is the farm where Washington lived between the ages of 6 and 22. It's about 55 miles south of downtown Washington, D.C., and just outside of Fredericksburg. Tickets are $9 for adults, $4.50 for students. Children 6 and younger get in free. A self-guided iPad tour and 40-minute tour of the reconstructed house are included in your price of admission. A special Independence Day event, including historical reenactments and demonstrations, music, crafts, and games, will be held on July 4th at a cost of $1 a person. Then we have George Washington's Mount Vernon, and that's at 3200 Mount Vernon Memorial Highway, in Mount Vernon, Virginia. And you can find more online at mountvernon.org, mountvernon.org. This is the estate where Washington lived most of his life and is most well known for. It's at the southern end of the George Washington Memorial Parkway in Fairfax County. In addition to mansion tours and the Museum and Education Center, it offers tours of Washington's distillery and gristmill, gardens and groves, and Washington's tomb. And, of course, Martha, his wife, is also buried there. Other special tours focus on First First Lady Martha Washington, the enslaved people who lived and worked at Mount Vernon, and music of the Revolution. Mount Vernon also has special activities for children. And online tickets start at $18 rather for adults, $11 for children, 6 to 11, free for younger children. There is an additional cost for some of the special tours and activities. Again, more information available at mountvernon.org. That's mountvernon.org. By the way, writer Jim Barnes, as we said, is based in Leesburg, Virginia, and he reminded me, when I read his article, of the event that happened as my family and I were returning from a trip from Maryland's Eastern Shore a few years ago. As we traveled along, we spotted a road sign about George Washington's boyhood home, and it wasn't far after we left Dahlgren, Virginia, which is a big naval base, and that's along U.S. 301. Now, until that time, I'd always equated Washington simply with Mount Vernon. Well, we decided to check this out, and as Jim Barnes' article affirms, it's worth the visit because we saw the foundation for Washington's first home when we visited, and today you can enjoy the recreation. And I must add that the docents are very visitor-friendly and more than willing to answer your questions, so you don't have to rely just on the iPad. One thing that fascinated me, having grown up in a town noted for tobacco, was the type of tobacco that was grown during Washington's childhood years and how it was harvested and processed at that time. So if you're a native North Carolinian or grew somewhere up in the tobacco belt of the South and wanted to see, check that out, it'd be worth your visit. Now, Liz Beatty is going to be our next host, and she produces and hosts the award-winning broadcast and podcast Native Traveler on SiriusXM. She's also the author of the December 2018, January 2019 National Geographic Traveler Quest column on the city of Nashville, Tennessee. Now, she titles her essay, The Look of Sound in Praise of Letterpress in Nashville, where music and old-school design have long harmonized. So this sounds like a fun trip, so let's take a look. On an early Sunday morning in January, Nashville's Lower Broadway, Lower Broad to locals, looks like the day after a zombie apocalypse. There's not a soul in sight for two full blocks, save one homeless fellow in an alcove next to an Elvis statue. I pull the last $2 from my pocket and hand them to him. I pass the purple-painted Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. In earlier days, this gritty watering hole welcomed Mel Tillis, Waylon Jennings, and Patsy Cline, just a few of the headliners who would slip across the alley from the Ryman Auditorium for a quick drink. On quieter nights, a famous face may still drop into play with the revered house band. Doors all along the street are now shut beneath unlit neon signs, more than a few in the shape of guitars. Some of the best but lesser-known country musicians anywhere played these venues last night in the coveted after 10 p.m. Saturday slot. But, as is increasingly the case, many went unnoticed among the growing number of raucous bachelorette parties and convention goers. Nashville is booming. About 100 people a day are said to move here, and the visitor count is approaching 15 million annually, with record increases year after year. I try to conjure the riotous scene along this strip just hours earlier, pounding music, neon, visitors spilling out of bars. For many, the now desolate streetscape would mean one sad thing, the show's over. For me, however, and what I'm looking for, I'm right on time. By noon, I stand on the shop floor of Nashville's Hatch Show Print, one of the oldest running letterpress shops in North America. Hatch opened its doors the year Thomas Edison invented the incandescent light bulb. While nearby shops printed newspapers and Bibles, Hatch hitched its future to the 20th century birth and evolution of country music, and eventually every music genre. Hatch presses have pumped out rather show posters for everyone from Hank Williams Jr. and Dolly Parton to Paul McCartney, Led Zeppelin, and the Beastie Boys, every run using movable type technology dating back to the era of the Gutenberg Bible. As the owner of several milk crates of vintage vinyl, I revel in this analog motherlode of Nashville lore. Way beyond cowboy boots and honky-tonk, I want to know Music City through the art of Music City. To my right, a 1960s Vandercook press the size of a sideboard is covered with celebrity signatures from the likes of ZZ Top and Weird Al Yankovic. Across the room, a 60-foot wall of warped and crooked shelves holds almost 14 decades of metal and wooden-type blocks, along carved images of past customers such as Herbert Hoover and Anderson Cooper. Finished works serve as wallpaper. We're a constant here, says hat shop manager Celine Aubrey. We're telling the story of how the city changes, how the country changes. It's Sunday, so I can only imagine the cacophony of clickety-clacks, thuds, and whirs of full production mode. There are 10 different makes and vintages of presses, including a Zigwall Platin from 1896. Each poster is unique, with the density of ink, how it transfers to the paper. It's all done by hand, locking in the type blocks, cranking each page through, one sheet at a time, one color at a time. Rest strikes of an infamous Elvis poster, once decried by a Southern preacher for being too central, are made with the exact print blocks of the original run. Even new commissions use vintage type. This attention to detail preserves their seminal American graphic character. Bold colors, chunky block letters, no nonsense. It's a design style many recognize, even if they don't know it comes from Hatch. Growing fascination with letterpress, vinyl, and all things analog is no surprise to Aubrey. When you go extreme into the digital world, the natural reaction is to swing back to things that are handmade, she says. We have graphic designers come back to Hatch to reground themselves. Behind the shop's iron gates, marked 1879, the year Hatch opened, it's easy to forget that this slightly steampunk scene is a functional recreation. Each historic drawer and inkpot was lovingly packed up from the 316 Lower Broad locale and then reassembled in the great expansion of the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2013. An 80-foot tall wall, of glass showcases the shop's inner workings to passersby in the Country Music Hall of Fame foyer. It's striking, but a reminder that Hatch is a working museum. The best way to find Hatch's mark on Nashville today, on those who carry forward these printing traditions, is to talk to the locals. It's a lot like hot and cold running water. Show posters are just part of our culture here, says former Hatch trainee Bryce McLeod. McLeod is 43, tall, slender, with salt and pepper beard and smiling eyes. Unlike many former trainees from around the globe, McLeod grew up outside Nashville in the same town as Johnny Cash and June Carter. As sculptor and 21st century letterpress master, McLeod opened his shop, Isle of Printing, in 1997 in an edgy downtown enclave nicknamed Pie Town, a slice-shaped neighborhood west of Bridgestone Arena. Inside McLeod's strip mall studio, there's endless creative clutter. Self-portraits made by Nashvillians with small print stamps and a poster he designed for Bob Dylan. Some call McLeod the Willy Wonka of modern letterpress for his whimsy, his intuition, and perhaps most of all, his unusual business plan. The reason I created Isle of Printing was that I wanted to change the world with art, he says, spreading ink on his Vandercook press. He locks in type blocks and cranks it up. It's a bold statement, but you gotta shoot for something. He pauses, pointing out at a smear of magenta pigment across the moving roller. Hear that? When the ink's just right, it kind of sounds like sizzling bacon. With commercial profits, McLeod commissions himself and a team of other artists to make community art. His project, All Are Welcome, gathered ambassadors from Nashville's Kurdish, Nepalese, Mexican, Arab, and 15 other ethnic groups, including native Nashvillians. They talked about the concept of welcome in their cultures and printed T-shirts that said welcome in their native languages. We wanted the gringos, so to speak, to be wandering around in T-shirts that said welcome in Arabic, says McLeod. His many community art adventures share similar motivations. Art, McLeod thinks, can unite Nashvillians, helping them share and expand their world without abandoning who they are. The recent growth in Nashville is breathtaking, he says. But losing community is one thing we're afraid of. The best thing about Nashville isn't the buildings, it's the culture of the people. More humble evidence of those who've shaped Music City is never far away. Long before fine art, portraits, and stadium concert keepsakes, letterpress posters were straight-up advertising. On alley walls and barn doors, show posters clearly and engagingly communicated who, where, and when. You'll still find these artifacts of great music moments all around town, hiding in plain sight. Amid massive growth and change, locals sometimes pine for the days when you could just show up to venues like the Bluebird Cafe for a quick beer and a fix of bluesy talent with no line out front to get in. I discovered it's still possible to catch a bluegrass Grammy winner inside the scruffy station inn on a Monday night. Wall-to-wall yellowed show posters surround the half-full room of locals, reminders of 44 years of concerts on this Gulch neighborhood stage. Phones lie face down and conversations stop as the music begins. Nashvillians understand a live performance is a singular confluence of time, place, musicianship, and audience, never to be repeated. But neither will it be forgotten, because plastered somewhere there's a show poster to remember this night forever. And so there you go. Liz Beatty, a producer and writer, and her show is on Sirius XM, and it is called Native Traveler. So some interesting things there. And speaking of hot art in the city, she has some tips about the specific art locations in Nashville. If you're interested, there's Noelle, N-O-E-L-L-E. In Printer's Alley, the newly reopened Noelle Hotel, circa 1929, showcases letterpress portraits and art installations, all created of curated by Bryce McLeod of lesser-known Nashvillians of note, civil rights activists, burlesque dancers, and others who shaped local history. And you can find out more online at noel-nashville.com, noel-nashville.com. Then we have the Pinewood Social. McLeod's metal cans with letterpress labels make for playful art installation in the vintage bowling lanes at Pinewood Social. This industrial cool gathering spot near the riverfront offers burgers, craft cocktails, karaoke, dipping pools, and bocce ball court. PinewoodSocial.com is where you find more information online, PinewoodSocial.com. Then we have the Frist. Boy, is that easy to get messed up, isn't it? Frist, F-R-I-S-T, Frist Art Museum. In Nashville's 1930s Art Deco former post office building, the Frist hosts world-class rotating shows. In 2019, look for exhibitions on photographer Dorothea Lange, French Impressionist, and Frida Kahlo. And it's fristartmuseum.org, fristartmuseum.org for more information online. Then we have the very famous Ryman Auditorium Gallery, and this is worth a visit. Many call the 126-year-old Ryman the mother church of country music. Its galleries of hats, show posters tells an even bigger story, celebrating acts from Harry Houdini to Russian ballerina Anna Pavlova, Louis Armstrong to Smokey Robinson. And you can get more information online at Ryman.com, R-Y-M-A-N, Ryman.com. So lots to do there in Nashville, and it is fascinating. I must say, in my time to visit Nashville, some of these things had not even been put together. There was, across from the Country Music Hall of Fame, the old Conway Twitty record store. And just to describe the scene that Liz Beatty kind of tries to give us there, you'd walk in, just look at rows of records in racks, just like a typical record store, but at the back of the store was a curtain, and it was a stage, and occasionally it would open, and there would be an artist playing acoustically with just a little amplification from a microphone, and that was it. And it could be any artist who just wanted to show up and do a couple of songs for you. So it was a fascinating time to just visit there. And the museum itself, we've had some previous episodes of Armchair Traveler where we've described a Country Music Hall of Fame. Elvis's convertible there, his Cadillac convertible. That's the one that has the 45 RPM record player in the back. And you get to see all that, plus lots of the famous country music stars' costumes that they used during their tours. So a lot of fun there in Nashville, and something to think about if you like to head in that direction. Well, for us, we've come to the end of our journey for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you'll be listening next time, that you've enjoyed your trip today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Any questions or comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.